right, we are back. I'm Janine. This is Get the Funk Out. And next up is Dr. Jessica Borelli, professor of psychological science. And she's written this incredible book. She's co-written it. It's called Nature Meets Nurture. And she's standing by with us right now. It talks about science-based strategies for raising resilient kids. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So I heard about you. This was so relevant to the show. I don't know if you know the show is called Get the Funk Out.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm really passionate about mental health, especially, you know, when kids are younger. And there's been so much going on, obviously, as you know, with mental health and COVID. And so maybe you could just give us a little backstory about how this came about.
How my book project came about?
Yes, your book, yes.
Yeah, well, my colleague Stacey Dewan and I had actually started writing the book before the pandemic. But then, you know, when the pandemic hit, it became even more relevant to be writing a book like this. Mm-hmm. And as you're probably aware, you know, kids' mental health was already at an all-time low before the pandemic hit. And then the pandemic just kind of pushed things even further down. So the need to be really focusing on this as an area of concern, you know, was already present and then has just become an even more pressing issue since that point. So I think that we're probably on the same page in terms of thinking that our focus should really be on this as being an incredibly important area to be thinking about, you know, as important or more important than kids' academic achievement or other things that, that a lot of people are really focused on.
Yes. Yeah. I think about how important STEM and STEAM is and how certain things were adopted into the curriculum. And I always think, why wasn't mental health embedded into the curriculum as the foundation of importance?
Right. And you do see, I mean, now, and I think it's more common to see educators and schools thinking about social emotional learning and paying more attention to things like anxiety reduction or stress or mindfulness or things like that. But it's not to the degree that, for example, there's always going to be a math class or there's always going to be something like that. So it's not elevated to that level, and I think that it probably really should be.
Yes. I'm also hearing, especially from UCI students, because I have a mental health initiative aside from this, is that coming back, and it's not just me seeing this on campus. I actually went to an event at UCLA, the Friends of the Semmel. They had a Gen Z summit. And one of the biggest issues is that the lack of connection, that, you know, students got used to feeling socially isolated. And if you're already introverted, you know, then you really have a tendency to still feel uncomfortable. But more so coming back, there's this sense of lack of connection. It's hard to make friends. That's what I'm hearing.
Right. Yeah, I'm also in my role as a professor and also as a practicing psychologist hearing that a lot from people as well. And it was something that I worried about a lot when we were all at home, you know, sheltering at home. I worried that the transition back would be a lot harder than anything we had anticipated. For everybody, and particularly for people who are prone to any kind of social anxiety or people who are more introverted, because that's what, you know, all of the research about anxiety kind of tells us, is that when we avoid things that are more challenging for us, then confronting them again becomes even harder.
Sure.
And I think that that's a lot of what we've seen, is that, you know, we kind of created these systems. During the pandemic, we created a lot of systems that allowed us to live life in a more convenient way without interaction, without interacting with people. So, for instance, it became a lot more common to order groceries to be delivered, and DoorDash became a lot more commonly used. And just, like, we set up our lives to be structured so that we didn't have to interact with people. Mm-hmm. And then it took away kind of the we kind of ungreased the wheel, so to speak. We like took away this the practice of just kind of getting used to all those little uncomfortable interactions that we have, and that we were kind of pushing ourselves through on the day to day. And now, if you have to do that, it's kind of like, why? Why would I push myself to do that? Why would I push myself to leave my home, the comfort of my home, to get out of the house, to go to class?
Yes.
Or
yeah.
to raise my hand to have an interaction with someone when I don't want to and I don't have to, and it's going to increase some discomfort or anxiety, when I could just not. I could stay home.
Right.
I could watch a lecture online. I could do so many different
yes.
things that would make me so much more comfortable.
You bet. You bet. And for any students listening, it's not just you. I get social anxiety, and I'm an adult. I was going back to events that I really like. And I was thinking, I'm having a hard time, like, connecting with people sitting around a round table with 10 people. Everybody is either on their phone, and I'm feeling socially awkward, but you can sense the awkwardness, the discomfort, and the COVID changed everything.
I think it absolutely did, because I just think it changed kind of the ratio of benefits to costs in some ways, and people started evaluating those things differently.
Yes.
And then, as you're saying, people started participating in a different way, too. So I think that, you know, even when you're present, there's a different way of engaging. Maybe because there's more anxiety or because there's more discomfort. So people, when they're present, they're kind of still not fully present. And that makes
yeah.
interactions more uncomfortable.
Definitely. So as
yeah.
you...
And I really appreciate you sharing, too.
Oh,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
you know what? I feel like... I like to be an open book because
yeah.
I see the struggles that are going on with college students, especially right here on campus. And,
yeah.
and you know, they'll share with me, hard to make friends, or I'm anxious, depressed. And I often ask the question, how are you really? And we're not asking
yeah.
that question.
Right.
So when you were writing the book with Stacy, you must have been, you know, here you are in a pandemic and thinking, oh my gosh, this book is so timely. Who would have thought?
Yeah. Yeah, I was. So we had written the majority of the book before kind of things shut down, and then we were reviewing and revising as the pandemic was happening. And part of me was thinking, wow, we should be updating this for the pandemic. We should be
right.
changing things. But we were only allowed to change
oh.
so much at that point, you know, because that was kind of the stage when, I don't know if you've written a book before, but this was kind of the stage where we're, well, you told me that you had before.
It's okay.
This is kind of the stage where we're, you know, only allowed to make small edits, basically.
I know. Yes.
So,
and you're like, wait, but I have a whole new chapter.
There's so many more things that could have been added at that point because, but at the same time, I was rereading and thinking that actually what we had written felt so alive and important,
mm-hmm.
And actually still so relevant
yeah.
for the context, yeah.
But in the book, you share parenting strategies that foster happiness, coping, and well-being. Now, I'm sure when you're doing book talks, I don't know if you're doing also workshops, you're probably
yeah.
adding to the equation of, oh, by the way, post-pandemic, here's what else we know.
Yeah, because I think that the way that I kind of talk about this to parents and to families is to think about, you know, there was life pre-pandemic when we used to talk to parents about preparing your child for the transition to summer and the transition to back to school. We would talk about like one transition at a time and how transitions of that kind of magnitude were challenging. And then there was life kind of during the shutdown when kids were hit with 50 transitions at once, for instance. And those were the kind of fortunate kids who only had school shutdowns and changes in their family rhythms. And then there were the kids who had, you know, deaths in their family and major illness disruptions
sure.
and families losing jobs. And I mean, so many life adjustments. And you know, and then there were many other types of insults. So I think that the magnitude, just the sheer number of stressful life events that children
yeah.
experience and that parents experience at the same time just was incredible.
Yes.
And the number of adjustments that families had to adapt to in that same moment. So, and then there was life kind of following in,
mm-hmm.
in kind of the stage that we're in now where we're kind of adapting in the aftermath. And now I kind of talk to parents about helping kids pick up the pieces and figure out what they've learned from
mm-hmm.
having to adjust in those ways. And I actually do think that kids have learned a lot.
Oh, yes.
And that families have learned a lot about different ways to cope and different ways to learn, you know, study and
mm-hmm.
Adapt. But also there have been battle scars, too.
Sure. I also hear stories from students that said, you know, I wasn't a very good student before, But I took a deep dive and discovered, you know what, I'm actually smarter than I thought. And they found a new direction for their life by having all that time to sit in their thoughts.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I've heard from, for example, families where they took advantage in a really positive way of the time that they had at home. Mm-hmm. Together to, for example, learn new things about their kids, learn new ways that their kids, for example, kids with like learning disabilities where the kid had been really challenged in the school environment and had been struggling, but then the parent got a unique front row seat and was able to really kind of understand in a new way, these are the things that really help my child and these are the things that don't help my child. And then they were able to communicate for the first time to the teachers, this is what my child really needs, and they hadn't been able to really communicate that before because they had never been able to see their child learning in that kind of live way before. Mm-hmm. So things like that, or, you know, families that really felt like they really got to connect in a way with their children just because of the time they had together during that time. So really, really positive, wonderful things coming out of that time. And then, of course, there are many negative stories as well where the stress of being together was really challenging or many other things too.
You know what I would love to see, and thank you for sharing that, by the way. I'd mm-hmm. love to see that schools, colleges, universities would consider, and you know, maybe this would have been a great idea a couple of years ago when things were back in person, but is considering the whole student. So for instance, a student that had to take care of a sibling, that lost a parent, that had mm-hmm. a part-time job, that did online school, you know what I mean? Like, look at the whole student and not just the scores and the grades, but look at
you
this.
Mean in the admissions process.
Correct.
Because
that really says so much more about a student than just a score and a number to me. Yes,
absolutely. And you know, the ways in which that person has contributed to their family and grown as a person and just been a member of our society is hugely important and much more important than, you know, how they academically achieved, you know, so to speak.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I know we have a little less than 10 minutes, but would you like to share some highlights of your book?
Sure. So I think, you know, when we started out writing the book, we were mostly focused on trying to write this book from this perspective of thinking about kind of writing in response to this idea that people's biology or people's genetic heritage can be predetermine their kind of outcomes, and trying to think about can we speak to parents about what they can do from a parenting angle given their child's kind of genetic background. Mm-hmm. So there has been all this research in the past 20 years on epigenetics. Are you familiar with that
a little
term,
bit.
Epigenetics?
A little bit.
Yeah, so epigenetics is like a field basically started by this researcher named Michael Meany, but then a lot of other researchers have contributed to it. And it basically is this idea that, you know, we all have our genetic kind of code, our genetic background, and that's basically thought to be inherited and not changeable for the most part. So we kind of have this, you know, genetic code that we get from both of our parents. But we more or less think about those as being fixed. But then the really interesting contribution that, and this has been really work that's been done in the past 20 years, and it's been really revolutionary, is that what we've learned is that actually what we then pass on to our children can actually be altered. The genetic code can be altered. So it's not fixed.
Okay.
It can be altered as a function of our experience in our own lives.
That's so
just like
it's
super, super fascinating.
Yes.
So an example of that, and this has been mostly shown in animal models, but we think that it also transpires in human beings as well. We don't have reasons to think that it doesn't. So an example of this would be if you put rodents, for example, who have a genetic background that would be linked to, for example, having a highly emotionally reactive genetic background, and you put them in an environment where they're being reared by caregivers that are very, very soothing. So they do a lot of this behavior that's called high licking and grooming behavior. So that's where the rodent mom licks and grooms the infant little rodent a lot, and also engages in this type of nursing behavior called high arched back nursing behavior. And these are the types of behaviors that little rodent moms do when they're soothing their babies. It's very good for the baby's nervous system development. And so if you basically do what's called cross-fostering, so you like give this little highly reactive, genetically reactive rodent a new mom that they don't know, you know.
Sounds like a reality show.
They don't know that they've been switched. Yeah. Yes. Very exciting research. Yeah. And you switch their mom, and then they're raised by this mom that has a different genetic code and is behaving in this way that's very, very soothing. Then actually their own genetic, the genes that they have actually get switched through this process called DNA methylation, and I can't even speak in a clear way about this because I'm not a geneticist.
That's so interesting.
But what I can tell you is that it gets switched so that what they pass on to their own infants is actually more consistent with the genetic code of someone who, of a rodent that's got like a high licking grooming mom. And also, the amazing thing is that when this little infant grows up, they will engage in the behavior of high licking grooming or high arched-back nursing themselves. So not only have we changed their genetic code, but we've also changed their behavior.
Amazing.
And it is really, really amazing. And we kind of have known some of these things to be true from research within kind of closer to my own field of attachment research. We've known that if we raise children and we expose them to sensitive caregiving, to caregivers who are going to treat them with love and warmth and respect, that generally speaking, they grow up to also treat their own children in that way. But the piece that we didn't really understand is that it actually can modify the genetic code as well.
That's fascinating.
Really exciting, yeah. So in an era where we're thinking about genes as being really deterministic and, you know, what happens if you're born with this kind of genetic risk factor for mental health or for other types of vulnerabilities, is it determinist? Like, is it going to set you on a course that you can't get off of?
Yes.
Well, it kind of, the answer to that question kind of depends on what it is, but also I think a lot of the things that are coming out in the research are really just much, much, much more nuanced and show a really profound role of the impact of environment. And what we're really focused on in our work is caregiving environment.
Amazing. So we do have to wrap up, but I am thinking ahead that I would love to have you call back in again.
Sure. Okay. I would love to talk to you.
That would be fantastic. Well, where can people find out more about you and your book?
Yeah, so you can find me on the UCI website. I have a faculty webpage, or you can find me, I have my own personal professional website. It's drjessicaborelli.com.
Congratulations on your book.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. And I'm going to have you on again. I'll be in touch.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. That was Dr. Jessica Borelli, professor of psychological science. If you missed any part of this conversation, it will be up as a podcast very shortly. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Janine. This is Get the Funk Out, and I'll be back next week. Have a great one.